Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. How does the human mind make decisions, and how can we make those decisions better? And what happens if we think too much? What constitutes a moral decision? These are some of the questions that Jonah Lehrer addresses in his fascinating new book, How We Decide, which draws on research in neuroscience and behavioral economics, which has revolutionized our understanding of human decision-making. Obviously, all of you are here in an Allowed program tonight, so you've already made one very good decision. But reading Lehrer's new book, How We Decide, might make you an even better decider. Jonah Lehrer is editor-at-large for Seed Magazine and the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist and a graduate of Columbia University and a Rhodes Scholar. And he admitted that his sport that he for his Rhodes was that he was actually a chef and a cook. So it's a very enterprising young man. He's worked in the lab of Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist Eric Kandel and has written for The New Yorker, Wired, The Boston Globe, The Washington Post, and Nature. And he writes a highly regarded blog, The Frontal Cortex. He also is a commentator for NPR's Radiolab, which reminds me, if you would turn off your... Thank you very much, your cell phones and pagers. In conversation with Jonah tonight is Dr. Larry Swanson, who is the Appleman Professor of Biological Sciences and a member of the Neuroscience Research Institute at USC. This is our second faculty member from in neurosciences from USC. We had Antoine Bichara last week with Dacher Keltner, so it's all home week for USC. At USC, Dr. Swanson directs a laboratory investigating brain systems that control motivation and emotion. His recent book, Brain Architecture, Understanding the Basic Plan, presents a new theory of nervous system organization, and his atlas, Brain Maps, is in its third edition. He and his wife, Neely, who is here in the audience, have translated three classic works of Santiago Ramon y Cajal, who was the winner of the 1906 Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology, and who is considered one of the founders of modern neuroscience. It's kind of boggling because those translations include Cajal's 2,000-page masterpiece, The Histology of the Nervous System, and his Advice to a Young Investigator. Dr. Swanson is also a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. So without further ado, please welcome Jonah Lehrer and Dr. Larry Swanson to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Joan, it's been a pleasure getting to know you a little bit and to know that you actually grew up in Los Feliz and really are a native LA person.
It's an honor to be here, and I should say at the beginning, it's a special honor to be talking to such an eminent scientist. I'm very aware tonight of one of my favorite lines from W.H. Auden, where he described how being in a room full of scientists was like being a shabby curate in a room full of dukes. I know the feeling entirely, especially tonight.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this conversation because I thoroughly enjoyed reading the book. You probably saw it out in the lobby out there. It's got a picture of three ice cream cones on there. And how do we decide? You know, is it the vanilla, the strawberry, or whatever? But the range of topics in this book is absolutely incredible. You know, going from how people choke in golf to autism, all sorts of fascinating topics, which in the end boil down to a way that a lot of us have tended to think in Western society about decision-making, how it's a very logical process, and this goes back to that emotions are bad for making decisions, and it sort of goes back to Plato, who likened the mind to a chariot drawn by two horses, And so one was the emotions and one was reason or rationale. And the ideal world for Plato was the purely rational world. Well, what's great about this book is that based on some very new fields, really, like decision-making theory and neuroscience, some of these assumptions that we sort of, many of us, take for granted, turns out that some of this modern thinking comes to almost the opposite conclusion. And I thought one of the great topics that is very germane today is the stock market. You know, and a lot of people think, oh my God, all right, the more I study certain companies, the more I know about them, the more I fiddle around and play with the stock every day, you know, the better off I'm going to be. And that was one of the great stories, I think, in the book was, you know, modern thinking about the stock market, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, an economist would refer to the stock market as a random walk, which means that you can't use the past movement of any particular stock to predict its future movement. And that would suggest, and one of the implications of that theory, is that knowing all the information in the world, unless it's a legal inside information, won't help you. And there have been some really elegant studies that have given two groups. One group had access to a very limited amount of information. All they could do is just follow share price moving up and down, while the other group was able to watch CNBC, read the Wall Street Journal, was fed all this information, you know, overdose on information. Needless to say, it turned out that the group fed much less information did far better in terms of picking stocks. They were less confident, but they did far better. And I think this gets back down to, I think, one of the problems with information overload, which is we love to see patterns. And with the stock market, because it's a random walk, you're seeing patterns that don't exist. So you've had all this information, you watch CNBC all the time, and you come up with all sorts of reasons why GE is going to do really well, or Bank of America, because they discovered how to package subprime loans, they're going to do great. And then things don't turn out so well. One of my other favorite experiments in the book that involves the stock market was done by a psychologist in Germany. And this gets back to, I think, why it might not be helpful to pick stocks with your rational brain, your prefrontal cortex, which takes in all this information deliberately. And he gave people, they had to watch TV, and at the bottom of the TV was a ticker tape like you see on CNBC with 20 shares and the price moving up and down. And so they have to watch this ticker tape for half an hour while they're distracted by the soap opera on television. And then he asked them, you know, so tell me which stocks did the best. Which stocks would you want to invest in now? And these people, obviously, you know, they said, this is way too much information. I couldn't keep track of these 20 stocks going up and down. I have no idea which stocks are the best. So he said, okay. Well, just tell me which stocks feel the best. Which stocks are associated with the most positive feelings to you? And lo and behold, when he asked them that question, all of a sudden now they were pretty good at actually finding the best stocks, the stocks that had gone up the most on this ticker tape. So that gets at, I think, one of the reasons information overload can be bad when it comes to things like the stock market is because our rational brain, you know, the deliberative part of the brain, doesn't always know which information is important. Should we listen to the talking head on CNBC or the guy in the Wall Street Journal? It's tough to really weigh all this information. And yet we've also been blessed with this magnificent unconscious supercomputer, which generates things like feelings, which can motivate us to, you know, invest in certain stocks. It's taking in more information than we're aware of. So I think it gets at, I think, you know, the stock market's been a very rich source of experiments.
It has, and there's this rational aspect of the stock market, and yet you see what we've had recently is these bubbles, and then the bubble bursts. And I think, you know, what's going on during that upward phase, you know, and then all of a sudden you got the got the downward phase.
There have been some elegant experiments done by a man named Reed Montague at the Baylor College of Medicine, and he actually puts people in brain scans and has them play historical stock market bubbles. So, you know, the Dow of 1928, the Nikkei of the 80s, the NASDAQ of the 90s, and then watches their brain activity. And it's a simple game they play. So they can choose how much of what percentage of their portfolio to allocate to the market. What you find is most people begin rather conservatively. They don't know they're playing a bubble. They just know they're playing a stock market that can go up or down. So most people begin with like 10% of their money in the stock market. They see that the stock market keeps on going up and up and up. That's because it's a bubble. They're playing the NASDAQ of the late 90s. You can't pick a bad stock. They're all going up. So obviously, they keep on putting more and more money in the market. And to make a long story short, he picks out a specific computational signal in the brain, which has to do with regret and is in dopamine-rich areas of the brain, which seem to be calculating. They're making predictions based on what they've seen, which is that the stock market will go up. And when it keeps on going up, this prediction's fulfilled. And so they get the rush of pleasure. Oh, I made more money. So they put more money in the stock market. Just about, Montague found that just about when the bubble has peaked, so you're talking the NASDAQ in 2000, you're talking the stock market was 14,000, you know, 9 months ago. It's amazing how quickly it falls. You're talking the Nikkei in 89. Just when the bubble's about to break, about to peak, that's when people start putting all their money in the market. He's begun to, I think, dissect to get a better sense of exactly what these signals he's picking up in a brain scan are actually encoding.
I guess part of, you know, a theme that runs through a lot of this is that there's a balance, really, between the emotions and the rational side of things. And, of course, you can go too far on either end, so that when there's too much emotion, certain things start to go wrong. And one of the great examples, I think, you talked about that was, you know, credit card spending, for example.
Yes, we've all been guilty of that, I'm sure. I know from personal experience, you find yourself, you know, at least I treat money a little bit differently when I'm just swiping a piece of plastic.
Exactly. And the decision is different.
Yeah, the decision feels different. A lot of this work, there's a fair amount of economics literature on how people, one of my favorite experiments was done by two MIT economists who had people bid for seats at a Boston Celtics game. And this is back in the early 90s. So they weren't studying the brain. They just wanted to know if these credit cards made people treat money differently. One group had to bid for the tickets with a credit card. The other group had to bid with cold, hard cash. The group who bid with credit cards ended up bidding twice as much money as the group who bid with cash. And I think for the first time we can understand why that is. And this gets back to what happens in your brain when you make a spending decision. And it turns out that there's this emotional tug of war. That, you know, when you contemplate a new object you want to buy, be it a shiny iPod or a red sweater, part of your brain looks at this new item and you get feelings of pleasure. And it seems to come from a brain area called the nucleus accumbens, which is rich in dopamine. And that's the pleasure of getting something new, the pleasure of getting a new iPod. It feels nice, you want to have it. At the same time, when you look at the price tag and contemplate paying for it, a part of the brain called the insula is turned on. The insula is generally associated with things like bodily pain, you know,
emotional pain,
feelings of disgust. It's not you don't want your insula to turn on. To make a long story short, and so normally there's this emotional tug of war, and you put people in a brain scan and you have them make these decisions whether or not they want to buy Harry Potter or you know the George Foreman electric grill, and you can predict their decision before they actually make a decision, depending on which brain area is more active. So if they're more excited about the pleasure of getting something new, or they're more sensitive to the pain of having to pay for it. That's with cash. When you put people in the same scanner and have them pay with a credit card, what you see is the insula is less aware of the cost of paying. You see reduced activity in the insula. And that makes sense because the transaction's abstract. You know, you're not taking out your wallet and taking out dollar bills and putting them one down, you know, one after another. Your wallet isn't lighter. You're just swiping a piece of plastic, and then in 30 days a bill will show up. But it's a much more abstract transaction, and this one little nub of brain, which helps us be responsible, which keeps us from spending too much money, is reduced. You know, shows reduced activity, and the end result is we rack up way too much credit card debt.
Well, I guess I think sort of a general principle came out of this, sort of a theory that's developing called risk aversion, which applies to a lot of these situations, doesn't it?
Yeah,
people. There's a ratio between the risk you're willing to take and what you're willing to pay for something, I think.
Yeah, and I think the emotional brain is great at many things, and I think what you often find is that, you know, these are hardwired software programs, for lack of a better metaphor, that evolved way back when we were chasing woolly mammoths in the Pleistocene. And you see that modern life is full of things like credit cards and the stock market that lead us to do all sorts of silly things and to misjudge risk, which is why we get scared being on a plane, but don't think twice about driving long distances. We're fantastically bad at really you know, really representing risk. And that's because risk is encoded as a feeling. So I think that gets at some of these hardwired flaws in the emotional brain. And I talk in the book specifically about a variety of risk aversion, which is known as loss aversion. That's a very simple idea, which is you give someone a coin, and, you know, we're going to make a bet on this coin. And so if it's heads, you pay me a dollar. And if it's tails, how much do I have to pay you before you'll accept the bet? And what you find is that if people were rational, if we acted like the people in economics textbooks, Larry would accept the bet when it was a dollar and a penny, right? Because chances are he would earn money. Odds are he'd make a penny on the bet. You know, that'd be the rational thing to do. The bet is in his favor. He should accept it. Turns out that people don't accept this bet unless I offer about $1.75 to $2. And so this is across cultures. It's across all sorts of betting scenarios. And what people have learned from this is that the pain of losing something like a dollar is about twice as much as the pleasure of getting something. You know, of getting something. Of getting that dollar.
I mean, it's amazing. There's basically, if people are working out a formula for this, you know, and applying it to economic theory, and et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, on the other hand, you think, okay, well, why not, you know, all of these emotions? What about just switching over and, you know, going all rational? Well, it turns out that there are some major problems with thinking too much, you know, like all of a sudden, you know, analyzing your golf game and, the more you analyze it, the worse you hit the ball. But that's sort of a trivial example. Jonah goes through some very interesting stuff in the book about, for example, taking standardized tests. And this turns out to be, there's a very interesting studies, really, on this.
This is a condition known as a stereotype threat, which is a variety of choking. I'll just backtrack for a second and talk about some of the studies you alluded to in terms of golf. And these are cute studies done by a psychologist named Sean Baylock. And what she does is she wanted to know why people choke, why Shaq can't make a free throw, why in the fourth quarter athletes tend to get nervous and become too self-conscious and choke. And so what she did was she brought amateur golfers and expert golfers into a lab and had them putt. And what she found was that amateur golfers, people are just learning how to putt, when they think about their stroke, when they think about, you know, I got to keep my wrist straight, I keep my hips straight, you know, bring it back in a neat straight arc, when they focus on these details of their stroke, they hit better shots. They make fewer beginner errors because the motion hasn't become automatic yet. So the more they think about it, the better their putts are. Experts, in contrast, people who already know how to putt, who are good golfers, the more they think about it, the worse their shot is. You know, if they focus on their wrist, then they start thinking too much, and this learned behavior starts becoming this deliberate thing, and they regress to a beginner's level. They start playing like a beginner. She's also shown that what experts should do, instead of fixating on, you know, their wrist or the details of the swing, they should focus on what's called a holistic cue word. You know, they should focus on the word like elegant or smooth. And that keeps them from thinking too much. But in terms of back to stereotype threat and your original question,
sort of almost in the Obama era, you can see some of this starting to happen.
Yeah, and there's been some initial evidence that the condition I'm about to describe has actually been reduced thanks to Obama. But this is known as a stereotype threat. It's been pioneered by a psychologist named Claude Steele at Stanford, and what he studied was. He brought in students of different races, white students and, for example, African-American students, and he said, I'm going to give you a test of intelligence. This measures your innate intelligence. And what he hypothesized was that this might trigger a subtle stereotype threat among the African-American students, that they would become worried thanks to, you know, fallacious books like The Bell Curve or something, that maybe they're not as intelligent as the white students, so they start thinking too much about these tests. They start thinking too much about, you know, the question, and that excess thought might interfere with their problem-solving abilities. So when he brought in these two groups and told them all, we're measuring your intelligence here, your hardwired intelligence, your innate intelligence, what he found was he replicated the achievement gap and that the white Stanford students performed better than African-American students. Then he repeated this with another group of Stanford students, white and African-American, except this time, he didn't tell them this was a test of intelligence. This time he said, this is just warm-up practice. Don't worry about it. We're not really measuring anything important here. We're just trying to get a sense. We're just trying to equilibrate stuff. Just do your best. It's not a big deal. Now the achievement gap all but disappeared. that because the stereotype threat condition wasn't activated, because the African-American students weren't worried about underperforming or fulfilling the stereotype as they perceived it, now they performed at the same level as white students. You can activate the same thing. He's since shown you can activate the stereotype threat with girls in math. You can activate it with white men in basketball. All sorts, you know, wherever there's a stereotype, people who are worried about making the stereotype true, about confirming it, experience too much thought. They in essence choke like a golfer on the 18th hole in some big PGA event.
Well, I think this is along the same lines, but then you went on to talk about the placebo effect, you know, giving a sugar pill to somebody and telling them it's, you know, going to cure their...
Anything.
But it's amazing how big that placebo effect actually is.
Yeah, I mean, it's very tough to... It turns out it's very tough to come up with a medicine that's more effective than a placebo effect. well, for a long time, you realize the history of medicine was nothing but the placebo effect. We were bleeding people dry, and it worked because of the placebo effect. So until the 20th century, that's all we had.
You know, and then his next... The final one in that chapter I thought was incredible. Back pain. Back pain and the advent of the MRI. This wonder machine that could now look into your body and see exactly what was wrong.
Yeah.
This was going to be, wasn't it? This was going to solve the problem.
Well, because surgeons were very frustrated that for a long time they'd been forced to diagnose back pain, which is by now practically an epidemic. It's a huge part of healthcare costs. And they'd been forced to use x-rays, which all x-rays can see. They give you a very limited amount of information. They can show you the spinal column and the vertebra, and that's about it. You can see the bones, but you can't see the soft, spongy tissue, the discs, all that other stuff. Then MRIs came along in the late 80s, and all of a sudden they could see everything. They could not just see the bones, they could see every disc, they could see herniated discs, they could see all these problems. And it turned out that most people's backs looked pretty ugly, that lots of people had herniated discs. People who came for back pain, sure enough, they all had herniated discs. So that became a very popular diagnosis. And then, of course, people had lots of spinal disc surgery, spinal fusion surgery, very expensive stuff. People ignored all sorts of evidence that maybe these surgeries weren't quite so effective. And now I think only in the last couple of years, thanks to some really elegant work done by people at Dartmouth and other places, have people exploded the idea that there is a correlation at all between spinal disc abnormalities and chronic back pain. You can take someone who has no back pain at all, put them in an MRI machine, and you see that they've got, you know, they've got spinal disc problems too. It's a normal part of the degeneration of the degeneration of the body, but it doesn't actually seem to cause pain. So that's why, you know, I use that in the book as an example. Last year, the American Medical Association came out with new guidelines, and their guidelines were you should only give MRI unless you think someone with back pain has a tumor. That this was an explicit diagnosis, explicit recommendation saying, too much information is bad for your decision making.
And yet, what are many doctors still doing?
Yes, and yet there was just an editorial saying it's time to listen to our last editorial, our last guidelines. Because it's very tough, I think, for people to acknowledge that sometimes too much information leads to worse decisions. I think especially if you're a doctor, and you know it's tough to admit that the rational brain has computational limits, that it's bounded, that it's a wonderful piece of machinery and pretty feeble in some respects too. So it's something that's especially hard for doctors to, and for patients too, to be fair, to say, you know, I'll make a better decision if I know less about your back.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So, you know, think about that for a second, and then, you know, then go on to the next thing, which takes things to a new level, really, morality, interactions, how people should deal with other people. Believe it or not, neuroscience and decision-making theory together are coming up with some new ways of thinking about that. And, you know, this is, I hope they're, you know, this should stimulate a lot of questions and discussion and everything, because, you know, the conclusion that's coming out of this is that there's really nothing rational about moral decisions, which is really turns a lot of people's thinking on its ear. But, you know, it'd be interesting to see how this way of thinking came about.
Well, you know, I think ever since Kant, people have been trying to justify human morality in rational terms. And you know, what especially interested me about kind of things, I think the new research into how people make moral decisions isn't necessarily because it overturns Kant, but really because I think it overturns how we think of ourselves, which is, I think we tend to see of ourselves, we've read the books on selfish genes, and we know about Darwin, and we see ourselves as kind of these Darwinian brutes, these Hobbesian brutes, who are just out for each other, you know, we're just out for ourselves, we're selfish, we just want to replicate and pass on our genes. We don't really care about other people when it comes down to it. Sometimes we're altruistic, but that's just an aberration. That at our core, we're these kind of bad, selfish creatures. And it turns out that's actually pretty wrong, that when you look at the brain, you can actually see that people, unless you're a psychopath, and I talk about psychopaths a fair amount in the moral decision-making chapter, have this innate capacity for sympathy, that you put someone in a scanner and you show them the face of someone suffering, someone in pain. You see their own brain areas light up as if they were in pain. Adam Smith, the father of economics, he called this fellow feeling. He wrote a whole book. The book he was most proud of was his book on morality. And he was one of the first people, along with David Hume, to say, you know, there's no way to really justify morality in terms of rational reasons. It's really about emotions. And it's about this specific ability of people to understand and naturally intuit the emotions of someone else. So you see someone else smile, you feel happy. You see someone else suffer, you suffer a little bit. I end the chapter with, I think, one of my favorite examples of this, which kind of hints at its evolutionary origins, which is an experiment. It's a pretty sadistic experiment, but they had monkeys, and they trained monkeys to pull on two chains. One chain gave them lots of their favorite food. The second chain gave them less of a food they didn't quite like so much, a pellet that didn't taste that good. Not surprisingly, all the monkeys learned to pull chain A because it gave them more food of the food they loved. Then, one day after the monkeys had learned the setup and were enjoying all this tasty food, the monkey across the hall, one monkey pulled on the chain for all the food, chain A, that gave them all the food they want. And as soon as he pulled on this chain, the monkey across the hall was given a powerful electrical shock, shrieked out in pain. All the monkeys in the other cage saw this monkey suffer. What did they do? Every monkey stopped pulling on the chain for a day or two. Some of the monkeys then just pulled on chain B. Some monkeys starved themselves for 12 days. That they were so afraid to make another stranger monkey they'd never seen suffer, give another shock, that they didn't eat. So that hints at, I think, too, why we have these moral emotions, which is, in the end, we're social primates. I mean, we're social primates. We had to learn to live in a group. And so to live in a group, what do you have to do? Not kill each other. And so one of the reasons we have these automatic moral instincts is so that it hurts us to hurt someone else. When you punch someone in the face, you feel pain too, and not just because your hand hurts. It doesn't feel good to make someone else hurt. And so I think that to me was an optimistic idea.
So part of this is that there actually is an innate component that actually most animals, all animals share. Animals have families, they live in groups, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's also the effects of upbringing, which are exceptionally important. And it's really a balance of those two. And Jonah had probably the best example of this in his book that I've ever read about the Romanian orphanages in the 1960s and the effect that this upbringing had on kids.
What I'm thinking about the emotional brain in terms of these moral circuitry is that it's hardwired, but it has to be turned on. That it's built into us, but you need to experience love in order to kind of have this fellow feeling, as Adam Smith put it. Kind of the circuitry has to be turned on. In the same way, you don't learn to see unless you have your critical period, unless you're exposed to the right kind of light, unless you're given light to enter your visual cortex. That the brain requires, during this critical period, a certain kind of influx of sensory stimuli and emotions the same way. So you see in children who are abused aberrant patterns in terms of these moral instincts. And of course, the tragedy of the Romanian orphanages, these are orphanages where children were horribly neglected. Some orphanages had a death rate of 25%. So tragic conditions. Children were just left in cribs for years and years. You can study these children in brain scanners and you can see differences in terms of how their brain processes the emotions of other people.
Of course, their behavior was
they can often have very troubling behavior. And you can read some of these case reports that have been compiled by psychologists, and you'll read about, you know, they just don't respond to pain in the same way, to seeing something else in pain. So there are some stories of just children throwing puppies out of a third floor window. One of the I think most effective treatments for these children is literally the parents are told to just hold the children as tight as possible to imitate, to mimic what they would feel as an infant. So these are grown children, sometimes teenagers, and one of the treatments that people prescribe is just to hold them, is just to bathe them in this love that they never got when they were 6 months old or 2 years old or 3 years old. And it's not a perfect treatment, but it's about as good as we got right now.
You know, a lot of what we've been talking about so far is what psychologists and economists and so on can measure about human behavior and so on and so forth. And you've mentioned some of the neuroscience part of it, but maybe you could say a little bit more about, you know, how much the modern science of the brain is helping to understand these sort of psychological things.
What's new
about this, really?
Well, I think one of the things that excites me about the field and excites me about neuroscience in general and decision making in particular, for the first time, I think we can draw connections between, you know, how our dopamine neurons process information, and then we can connect that to what we see in a brain scan, and then we connect that to what social psychologists and psychologists have been studying for a long time. We connect that to macroeconomics. And so you can really form these cross-cutting connections where you can talk about the insula, and you can talk about credit card debt, and you can talk about, you know, the subprime mortgage bubble. And you can draw these connections. And that's really what excites me. And I think for the first time, you know, we can drill down and get a better sense of how our dopamine neurons actually encode information and stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of new interesting research, which much of it and the stuff I'm most attracted to does fit into a larger narrative. One of the studies I talk about in the book is the work done by Walter Mischel on 4-year-olds. This is generally known as the marshmallow experiment, and these are experiments where these were done in the Bing Nursery School at Stanford between 68 and 74. And he brings 4-year-olds into his lab, and he says, okay, you can have one marshmallow right now, you can eat it right away, or if you wait till I run an errand and come back in 15 minutes, you can have a second marshmallow. So needless to say, this is a very agonizing decision for the 4-year-olds, and just about every 4-year-old decides to try to wait. So they say, I want the second marshmallow. What you immediately discover is that there's a tremendous variation among 4-year-olds. That some 4-year-olds can wait 30 seconds, and then they ring the bell and say, come back, I need to eat the marshmallows. He actually showed me some videos of these kids, and my favorite kid. You know, some kids are hilarious. They pull out their hair. They stand in the corner. They kick the table. They just turn around. But my favorite kid, he chose an Oreo cookie. You actually have a choice. It's not just marshmallows. You can choose Oreo, salty pretzels, marshmallows. And my favorite kid in the video, he's staring at this cookie, and he's really upset. You can tell he's really having a tough time waiting. So he comes up with a brilliant idea. He picks up the Oreo cookie, untwists it, licks the cream, puts it back together, looks around like that. And as Walter Mischel joked to me, that kid's on Wall Street now. So he did this protocol and found that there's this wide variation among 4-year-olds. And then the really surprising thing, I mean, that's not so surprising that some 4-year-olds are more self-controlled than others. The really surprising thing is he then followed these kids for the next 20 years. And sure enough, how kids performed as 4-year-olds on the marshmallow task was more predictive than just about any other test you could come up with. It was more predictive than the IQ test. It predicted stuff like body mass index, GPA, SAT scores, propensity to take drugs, just about everything. The difference between a kid who could wait a minute and a kid who could wait 10 minutes was that the kid who could wait 10 minutes had an SAT score 210 points higher. So a massive, massive difference, very, very predictive. And what's interesting about Mischel now is he's now, for the first time, putting these, they're now 40-year-olds, in brain scanners. So I think we've got the tools of modern neuroscience, and I think it's so exciting to see this really seminal psychology experiment. And now, for the first time, you can actually see well, what is it in the brain that represents this difference? He's doing genetic studies. Is this hardwired? So all sorts of interesting questions, and that really excites me as someone who covers this field.
That's fantastic. So out of all of this, you know, you say, well, you know, does any of this have any practical value, really? And, you know, the fact of the matter is, we won't go through all of it now, but there are some examples of where this kind of theory has really helped. And Jonah mentioned already reducing pilot error, for example. New methods of training to make decisions in the cockpit have helped things tremendously. And you go through at the end, you know, three or four or five sort of lessons that have come out of this.
And
maybe you could just mention, you know, good decision making, maybe what people have learned about how would you make good decisions?
Well, I think one of the most counterintuitive things for me, and this is preliminary work, and I think it's important that it really be confirmed, but I think right now, and this is it makes sense because it slots into a larger body of work. Some studies done by research at the University of the Netherlands, what they did was they wanted to know how people should make complex decisions. So decisions involving lots of information. And what they did was they began by giving people a simple decision. So they gave them four car options, and each car was represented with four different pieces of information. So car number one had a big trunk, 120 horsepower, but no anti-lock brakes, et cetera, et cetera. Car number two, et cetera, you know. So each car was rated on these four different pieces of information. One car was objectively ideal, you know. It scored the highest in three out of four categories. So this is a simple category. There are 16 total pieces of information. And what they found was that people do the best job of making a decision and finding the optimal car when they think about it, when they use their rational brain, look at all the information, make some notes, think it through, then they find car A, the optimal car. So that's the easy condition, not so realistic. You know, when you go to a real car dealership, there's so much information to consider. So the second experiment involved the same four cars, except now each car was represented in 12 different categories. So you had anti-lock brakes, trunk space, legroom, horsepower, fuel economy, et cetera, so lots and lots of information. So now the question is, how should people think about this? And what they found was that the best way to do it is something called, a theory they developed called unconscious thought theory, that the people who made the best decisions weren't the ones who really thought it through, who exercised their prefrontal cortex and tried to be rational and logical about it. They actually did terribly. They performed worse in random chance. The people who did best, who were actually really good at this, were the ones who, you know, they looked at the information, tried to take it in, and then they were distracted. They had to do a puzzle for the next 5 minutes. So while they were doing this puzzle and theoretically not thinking about the cars, then the scientists interrupted them and said, okay, quick, make a decision. What's the best car? And these people were the best at actually finding the optimal car. And what this gets back to, and I think the reason it's a suggestive result, because there's a large body of evidence suggesting that the unconscious, the emotional brain, is better at processing large amounts of information. Is better at finding the optimal car when there's too much information that exceeds the processing power of our prefrontal cortex, of our rational brain. You know, they've also done experiments in IKEA. Buying furniture turns out to be a really complicated thing. And that they compared shoppers in IKEA who were very rational about buying a leather couch versus shoppers who just, you know, were more impulsive, trusted their gut, et cetera, and that the people who are most satisfied with their couches were the people who just kind of went with what they felt was the best, didn't think too much about it. So that strikes me as very counterintuitive, the idea that it's the hard choices in life. You know, we may trust our emotional brain to pick dinner, but most of us would never trust our emotional brain to pick a car. And yet this research suggests that that's exactly backwards, that it's the simple decisions we should really think through, and it's the hard decisions we should actually trust our gut for. The larger, I think, takeaway lesson, and I think, you know, the most important lesson of the book, and the one I found most useful in my own life, is the one about metacognition. And I love that word because it's a fancy-sounding word, but it's really the simplest thing, which is thinking about thinking. The classic example of metacognition is tip-of-the-tongue syndrome, where, you know, we all know you run into the man on the street and you say, it's on the tip of my tongue. And that's always struck me as so profound, because how do you know what you don't know? How do you know it's in there somewhere if you can't produce the memory? And that's an example of metacognition in the sense that there's always some part of your brain which is kind of the internal watchdog, monitoring stuff. It knows you know that person's name. It just doesn't know it at the moment. And metacognition can be useful in decision-making in the sense that what it allows us to do is to adjust our thought process to the task at hand. You can say, well, given the decision I have to make now, I'm buying a car, a leather couch, or, you know, a vegetable peeler, how should I think about this decision? Which thought process should I most rely on? You can kind of adjust your thought process to the task at hand. And that, I think, is where this new research can really, I think, you know, improve everyday life, in the sense that for the first time we know how we should think. We know a bit about how our brain works, and so we can actually take this knowledge and apply it to everyday decision making.
Well, I mean, I think you can see that, you know, Jonah is exceptionally good at translating some very technical science into something people can understand. And I this is something I really admire, and, you know, not just necessarily in the two books, but, you know, he's got a couple of blogs going. And, you know, it'd be worthwhile. One of them is called Frontal Cortex, which I went and looked at, you know, and it's very interesting. And, you know, I'd just sort of like to know, you know, was it a lot of work to get it going? Is it worth it? Is it interesting? What do you really get out of your
That's a good question.
Out of your blog, actually?
you know, I do enjoy it. And I think for me what I've gotten most out of my blog, I mean, obviously there's the self-promotion aspect, you're a freelance writer.
You sort of have to.
Blog is helpful.
One.
Yeah, I think now it's in the contract. You sign up for the freelance union. You have to start a blog. just what the world needs, more blogs. But I think for me as a writer, what it has been helpful, and I'm amazed that I've been doing it now for a couple of years, is that writing is a craft. And so I think having to explain every day, having to read the new paper in Neuron and say, oh, I should blog about this because you blog because you really feel guilty because you haven't blogged that day. And so then you say, yeah, I should blog about this. And you learn how to write. And you know, I'm embarrassed when I go back and read my early blog entries just because I wasn't so good at it and still total work in progress, but it is a craft. And so I think the mere fact, in the same way Virginia Woolf, the same reason she said she wrote diaries, which was to learn how to write sentences, in the same way, I think for me, learning how to translate important scientific research is very much a craft and something I'm still utterly amateur and beginner at, but I think the blog, if nothing else, has helped me figure out how to make my sentences bit better.
Well, you're certainly not afraid to take on big topics. You know, I think, you know, decision making, you know, our life is full of it. But, you know, his first book, Proust Was a Neuroscientist, you know, stirred up a lot of interest because it was really a comparison of the arts and sciences. And the conclusion basically is that a lot of times, in general, the arts tend to lead the sciences in terms of creativity. And, I mean, this is another gigantic topic. So I guess just to round things off. I mean, what gigantic, interesting problems are coming next for you? What, do you have
the
another
neuroscience
book in mind?
Of God?
Yeah.
No, I'm still just tossing around some ideas. For now, I'm just enjoying. I'm writing some magazine articles. I'm excited about.
Terrific.
Hopefully you'll get another one soon. But I really had a fun time writing this book, especially I spent a lot of time with the first book in dusty libraries. This book I got to hang out with poker players in Vegas, which was a little bit more fun.
Well, thank you very much. I think we have time for some questions. And we have a microphone. So I think so that everybody can hear, I will get things going. But I see the gentleman here in the blue sweater.
My name is Todd Kerner. Fascinating discussion, and I've got about 12 questions I want to ask.
We'll
start
with one.
Of course, I'll limit it to just one. What is your opinion of pharmaceuticals to treat people who have maladjustments or problems with reasoning and emotional problems?
I mean, just in general, what do I? I mean, you know, I think it's you've got to be as ad hoc as possible about, you know, I think some drugs are more effective than others. It really depends, I think, very much on the specific drug you're talking about, the specific ailment. I think in general, my general response to that question would be it's kind of amazing. I think you can talk to scientists about this too. How little payoff there's been. We've learned so much about the brain over the last few decades. And how little payoff that's actually been in terms of pioneering new drugs. I think so many of our most effective drugs, like Prozac, are old. They're invented by accident decades ago. So I think the hope really is that for the, you know, in the next few years we'll have a payoff. And I think you can talk to scientists of various levels of optimism or pessimism about whether we'll get to this next generation. But I think one of the surprising things is we've learned so much about how synapses work, about all sorts of kinase enzymes, et cetera, et cetera. And yet we're still relying on, for the most part, the most popular drugs are drugs that are very old, that were developed long before we had any idea what Prozac actually works with or how Prozac works. And Prozac's a great example of, for the first time, I think we're getting closer to understanding what Prozac actually does. I think the old serotonin hypothesis is if not so oversimplified as to be wrong, just very, very oversimplified, that what Prozac actually seems to do is prevent neurodegeneration. It doesn't simply increase serotonin. It doesn't simply make you happier because it gives you more chemical happiness. It prevents this long degenerative neural process through stuff like upregulating things like BDNF and increasing neurogenesis. So I think we're finally getting to understand how these drugs were invented by accident a long time ago and why they actually work. But I should absolutely defer to.
No,
to
I think it's here. No. It's just that the brain is so much more complicated than the heart, for example.
Yes.
That we need more knowledge about how the brain actually works to develop effective drugs.
Yeah. One last point. I mean, one thing I find interesting about brain drugs is that they often have very, very odd and unpredictable side effects. And that's why I get a little suspicious. There's just an editorial on Nature advocating for we should all take cognitive enhancers. And the cognitive enhancer everyone talks about is stuff like, you know, when people who don't have ADHD take Ritalin, they can focus like a laser beam. Or they take drugs for narcolepsy. We can all dope ourselves, and we can all improve our focus. You may not sleep as much, but you can improve your focus. And I think there's some suggestive evidence that these drugs which improve your attention can actually decrease creativity. I had an article in the New Yorker last year which talked about the neuroscience of aha moments, what happens in your brain when you have an insight. And it turns out you're most likely to have an insight in the warm shower for a reason, that insights require this kind of relaxed, diffused attention. That's when you can best eavesdrop on these remote associations in your right hemisphere. There's a little bit of evidence that people who take Ritalin or drugs like that actually are worse at solving insight problems. And that's because you're so focused, you're less likely to listen to those things in your right, these remote associations in your right hemisphere. So the brain's so complicated that it tends to we don't quite know how to tweak it yet.
Down here in the front row? Yes.
In your story about the monkeys and pulling the cord and getting the food that they liked, and you interpreted the finding that the other monkeys stopped pulling the cord in a way that I found a little surprising, that they didn't want to give any pain to that monkey that had the pain. I would interpret the same story is that they didn't want to get caught in the same situation themselves.
Yeah.
How do you tell which interpretation is correct?
Yeah, well, I think the suggestive part was that they kept on pulling chain B. That then went back to pull chain B. But you know, that's a valid interpretation. I think you could easily argue for that. I think what suggests that they may be a sympathy is that may be based on their fellow feeling that there's this larger body of research showing that people do have this innate sympathy, but that's a excellent alternative.
So those scientists will probably go back and try and take that into account. Yes, this here in the back. Yes.
Hi, I was wondering if you had done any studies on stress or being in a stressful or traumatic situation that, you know, you couldn't even imagine being in, and how that might affect your ability to think clearly and be able to decide, and whether you think more emotionally or rationally, you know, in those situations.
Well, no, please.
No.
I don't do studies. I'm just a parasite on people. I talk in the bit in the book about very high-pressure, stressful situations. You know, I think the most relevant example is Captain Sullenberger landing on the Hudson. And I think maybe 20 years ago there were some people who would say that the reason people make better decisions like that, people can stay calm in the face of pressure, is because they don't get scared. You know, they don't feel the fear the rest of us feel. That's what makes them heroic and makes them such good deciders. And the important thing is to find those people who don't experience fear. There's some suggestive evidence showing, though, that everyone feels fear. As Captain Sullenberg admits, turmoil on the inside, calm on the outside, that everyone is terrified. In those situations, everybody's amygdala is pumping out fear and stress and anxiety. That's universal. What studies find, there's some variation, though, in terms of how well people's prefrontal cortex turns on in response to the amygdala. So some people, you don't see the accompanying activation in the quote-unquote rational brain. And I think that allows you to think through the fear, to kind of recognize your fear, say, I'm scared, and my fear isn't useful right now, and to then kind of think through it and make sure your fear doesn't turn into panic.
Over here in the front row.
So does science give us any insights maybe into how we should choose our leaders? So if we're on a board choosing a CEO, how do we choose a leader? Or if we're a citizen voting for mayor, how should we choose the mayor?
Excellent question. It's tough to offer prescriptive advice for that. I think we're just beginning to understand how people tend to actually choose their politicians. And it turns out not to be the most shocking, I know, the most rational decision we make. I don't include this in the book, but I think this always serves as a reminder to me of just how not quite rational our political beliefs are. It's done by a set of experiments done by a psychologist named Sheldon Solomon, and it's known as the mortality silence condition. And you can bring people into a room, and he did probably his best known experiment in 2004, and you can flash them stuff like WTC and 911. Things which remind you subliminally. These are all flashed subliminally, so they have no conscious awareness of seeing WTC or 911. And you can flash them the stuff, and then you ask them questions about, you know, and the control group is you just flash them 323, random area codes. And then you ask them questions about, how do you feel about Bush's foreign policy? How do you feel like President Bush? Do you think invading Iraq was a good idea? And it turns out that flashing people these things like WTC, 911, things that remind them of death. So it's not just 911, it's actually just reminding them of death in general. It makes people reliably more conservative. They're more likely to support the Iraq war. So I think that suggests that a lot of these political beliefs we hold aren't necessarily rational, aren't always grounded in all the facts. That we tend to, I think in the same way we make moral decisions based on these moral instincts that we then justify through an elaborate chain of reasoning. We then explain why, you know, why we did that and why it's wrong to do that. But that's ultimately rooted in, you know, this emotional instinct, this feeling we feel and can't quite explain. I think the same way many of our political beliefs and decisions are first they begin as a feeling, as an emotion, which we then come up with all sorts of reasons why we actually feel this way, why it's good to, you know, have a large stimulus bill, or why we should just lower taxes, stuff like that. But the initial belief, I think there's some evidence that it really begins. The important beginning of it is a feeling.
Yes, here in the front row.
As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but functional MRIs have been a great leap forward in understanding what's going on in the brain for neuroscientists. Is there anything on the horizon technologically that represents a similar or even greater leap forward for understanding?
Great question.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Probably more imaginative. It's a very good question.
Certainly fMRI, I think, is a great leap forward. I mean, I got to defer to the expert here on this one.
Sorry, no. I'd love to hear what you think. I'll be doing it tomorrow.
I recently wrote an article about something called connectomics, which is an endeavor to build a wiring diagram of the brain. We really don't know how cells connect at a cellular level. That I think, in the same way the genome transformed molecular biology, and people who study genetics, I think the connectome, which Professor Swanson is working on, could really transform the way we think about the brain. Ultimately, what you are is a mass of connections. ultimately these 3 pounds of gelatinous electrical flesh inside your head, what makes you you is simply how your cells connect and all the individual variation that suggests. So I think that going forward, and this is such a massive undertaking, you have to use future in really the future. This is several years down the road if you're a real optimist, just because there are trillion synaptic connections inside your head, so it's a lot of data. But I think that really could transform the field.
Let's go back up. Oh, there's still a lot of questions. Up in the back row, right on the end there. Yeah.
You talked about the brain's euphoria when you spend. Is there an equal or lesser when you save?
Oh, good question. The bad news is it doesn't seem so. The emotional brain isn't so great at when, you know, you can do these experiments. It's, you know, hyperbolic discounting, and you can ask people, basically, some of the best work's been done by a guy named John Cohen at Princeton. And you can ask people, you can watch how they make decisions. If you say, okay, right now you can have an Amazon gift certificate for $10. If you wait 2 weeks, you can have one for $12. And you can see that these two different options activate very different emotional circuits. That your emotional brain really wants the gift certificate right now. It wants the gratification. It wants this thing immediately. And meanwhile, your prefrontal cortex, in particular, a part of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, is kind of leaning towards the $12 option. You know, if we just wait another 2 weeks, we can have two more dollars to spend on Amazon. So that suggests that there really is this argument taking place when we decide whether or not to spend or save. That said, I think there are ways to be imaginative about tricking this circuitry we have, the fact that our emotional brain is very much rooted in the here and now. Some work done by Richard Thaler. He wrote an excellent book called Nudge, which he's a behavioral economist who's made some really big findings in the last few decades. And what he found was that the way to trick the brain into actually saving more money is he asked people, you know, when you ask people, do you want to save money? Do you want to put money in a 401k right now? And you get a pretty high success rate. It's like 60%. But the reason that's not 100% success rate is because people, it doesn't feel good to save. You know, you want to just spend your money. You don't like the idea of having to give up 2% of your paycheck every week. But then he found was that if you ask people, well, do you want to start a 401k in a month or 6 months? Now all of a sudden 98% of people say yes. Because you bypass this emotional circuitry, which is thinking about the here and now. You're basically asking a different question. You're giving them a different choice architecture, to use his term. So if you simply just shift the question to the future tense, all of a sudden the emotional brain is like, we don't know what the future is. We have no idea what you're talking about. And so now you can make a more rational decision and say, well, you know, it's probably a good idea to save a little money in my 401k, especially since my company's contributing or whatever. Or maybe that's a thing of the past. But you know, there are ways to get around that. And, you know, and I think one of the things that interests me about Obama is that I think he is very attuned to behavioral economics. He's hired some excellent people in his cabinet who Cass Sunstein, for example, who co-wrote Nudge, is in his cabinet. So there are people who are thinking about ways to do that. Given these frailties of the mind, how can we be a bit imaginative and kind of get around them?
Let's see here. Boy, this is getting random. Maybe the man and the gentleman in the blue shirt there.
Thank you. My question about choosing your wife, husband, or your partner, life partner. You know, you said something about by feeling go and pick a car when you have a lot of information. And about this partnership, we usually use just feeling, and most of the time is failing. Do you have any experience? I see you have a ring.
Yeah. Well, I was just listening to the radio today, and they told a great story about Darwin. When Darwin was figuring out whether or not to marry his wife, he made a long list of the pros and cons. And I certainly didn't do that. You know, love, I think for reasons, for many different reasons, remains very much a scientific mystery. We know that, you know, you can show someone a picture of a loved one in a brain scan, and you can see the dopamine. All the familiar dopamine networks turn on, and so you get all sorts of stupid headlines like love is like crack cocaine. What makes love, I think, particularly interesting in a brain scanner for a lot of scientists is that In many relationships, you can someone's been married for 30 years, and you show them the picture of their wife, and their brain will light up. You'll see the ventral striatum, nucleus accumbens, all these areas rich in dopamine, as if they'd just seen a reward for the first time, as if they'd just been given a new iPod. And that's kind of amazing. Sorry, that's my wife somewhere is very upset to be compared to an iPod. But I meant it in a romantic way. What I think is romantic about that is normally what happens to rewards, to things like iPods, is we adapt to them. We habituate. It ceases to make us happy. You know, your dopamine neurons stop firing. They get bored by it. That's why the iPod's exciting for a week. And yet, the face of a loved one can make you excited, can give you pleasure just looking at it for 30, 40, 50 years. There's no other reward in the world that can do that. So that said, we have no idea why. I mean, you know, all the other... Everything else remains a complete and utter mystery.
A lot of evolution behind that.
Yeah, excellent point. excellent point.
This goes way back.
Yes. This is the most primal parts of our primal brain. So the science can't quite offer love advice. To make a long story short.
Let's see. How about over here in the red shirt? Two or three? Okay.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I know it's... one of the very abstract conceptions or inventions that man had made is the written word. And to think or to listen to someone speaking or to speak could be, maybe I'm wrong, be a bit easier than sitting down and meditating on what you're going to write on paper or even reading, for instance, because you are, like filtering and reinterpreting, you know, what the other person is thinking somewhere, maybe a dead author. You write about Whitman, you spoke about Virginia Woolf. Do you think a poet, for instance, is more like riding a bicycle or somebody making a very intricate embroidery or a balance of both? Or when a person is lying or somebody's thinking good thoughts, would it register differently on a machine or some kind of something to gauge what the brain's the way the brain's working?
So I just make sure I understand the question. So the question is about how writing affects how we think?
The creative thinking, the mind, how it works. And has there been a study where, for instance, in particular, a writer would choose between two words and how he decides to choose the other?
Oh, interesting. Now, that's an excellent idea for a study. I'm not familiar with the study being done. I mean, the first experiments that come to my mind in response to that question involve some work done by a guy named Jonathan Schuller at UCSB, where he also studies the inside process, how people solve inside puzzles. These are puzzles that, you know, like the candle problem. You have to suspend a candle to the wall, and you have to melt wax. And what they generally require is, or the famous one about how to remove a dollar bill from underneath an upside-down pyramid. You know, so how do you do that and you can't move the pyramid? And the answers to these problems tend to come in a flash of insight. People don't, you can't methodically solve them, you know, step by step. You either have them in an aha moment or you don't have them at all. The answer to the pyramid, by the way, is you remove the dollar bill by setting it on fire. So people have the idea, oh, you burn the dollar bill. That's how you remove it. You don't actually have to keep it intact. That's an insight, and it comes all at once, a holistic idea. And as soon as you have the insight, you know it's right. You don't have to think for a second about it. In terms of how that plugs into language and writing, what Schuller's found is that the easiest way to inhibit an insight, to make sure, to guarantee that people don't come up with the right answer, is to make them put their thoughts down in writing. is to make them go step by step through the thought process. And then they never have the epiphany. And there are reasons he thinks that shifts the activity over to the left hemisphere, and it's the right hemisphere. That I think remains to be seen. But I think it shows how language can interfere with what we want to do, with problem solving. And I think in the case of decision making, you see that people, because we're blessed with this incredible faculty for language, means we're very good with coming up with reasons. And so we tend to come up with all sorts of reasons. I talk about a study involving strawberry jam and how thinking too much can lead people to actually misjudge their own preferences. And so they come up with all sorts of reasons why they should prefer jam A, even though they actually prefer jam B. And it's because jam A, you know, they start searching for reasons searching for ways to express in words why they prefer one jam to another. So maybe jam A is a chunky texture. So they say, well, a chunky texture is a good reason to like a jam. I should like jam A. When if you give them a blind taste test, they really like jam B. So this kind of shows how language, as magnificent as it is, can be a hiccup sometimes, can actually interfere with good decision-making and proper problem-solving.
Why don't we have two more relatively quick questions? How about the lady here? Sorry, it looks like we could go on all night here, yeah.
I was wondering if your research impacted a decision you've made recently.
Whew, good question. This is going to be a very embarrassing answer. I was recently on the Colbert Report, and
magnificent performance.
I've never been so nervous in my life. And I came, and my sister was coming with me, my older younger sister, and I came dressed up in my finest suit, and my tie, and she looked at me and said, oh, God, you look like an old person. And then she said, you have to wear a T-shirt underneath. I said, a T-shirt? I'll look like one of those idiots. You know, like, who wears a T-shirt underneath a suit and tie? And so I was agonizing for a half an hour in the green room. Should I wear a T-shirt or a suit and tie? And finally I said, you know, this is ridiculous. I'm going on to sell a book about decision-making. I can't make a decision about what shirt to wear. And then finally I said, well, you know, I kicked her out of the room and said, I'm going to do a test. I tried on both, looked in the mirror, and I felt better about how I looked. I said, this is definitely a complex decision. I should trust my emotional brain. And I ended up wearing a T-shirt. But you know, really what I was doing there is I was really trying to eavesdrop on what I felt more comfortable in, really trying to listen to kind of my own thoughts and to get past kind of what I felt I should be wearing. And it's such a trite, silly example. I apologize. That was the last really decision I remember agonizing over. This is more about my life, I'm afraid.
Okay, last one. I see in the gentleman in the suit there in the... Yeah. I'm sorry we can't get to everybody.
A lot of people make a lot of decisions with their gut, and some politicians seem to make gut decisions and make bad decisions.
You don't have any particular president in mind, do you?
God save the Queen. How do you separate gut feelings and thinking emotionally? Because it seems as if you could interpret your work as saying that the best decision is to just not think.
Absolutely not. I think it's something I would definitely. I think what I try to do in this book is say there are these two ways of thinking. Sometimes it's good to think one way. Sometimes it's good to think the other way. That it's all about adjusting your thought process to the task at hand. I think we talked about some of the ways the emotional brain can be just ridiculous. Can get, you know, and I've got a chapter in the book about all the hardwired flaws, things like loss aversion, things like we're terrible at dealing with randomness. We spend too much on our credit card. These are all hardwired flaws that, unless you're aware of these weaknesses, you're bound to repeat them. What I think we need to really do is think more. Is we need to think not just about being rational, but about how we think. Period. So in a sense, my self-help prescription is, you know, going meta is really thinking not just about, you know, which cereal to buy or about the decision at the moment, but thinking about how we're thinking about this decision. So I think what we need to do is think a lot more. In terms of President Bush, I think one of the ironies of his administration is, you know, as a decider is often lampooned for trusting his gut, is I think that his administration has coincided with a lot of research showing the kind of the impressive wisdom of the emotional brain in certain circumstances. I think what his administration is ultimately, you know, revealed some problems with was what psychologists called the certainty trap. And this plugs into things like groupthink, which is that one of the big problems with the way the human brain is wired is something called cognitive dissonance, which is that it's not pleasant for us to confront information that suggests we might be wrong, which is why, you know, liberals watch MSNBC and conservatives watch Fox. It feels nice to have your preconceived beliefs confirmed. And so I think given a large bureaucracy, you can see, you know, that more fundamental flaw, which is just a basic way we're built can really have astonishing consequences, and can lead people to believe things that in retrospect seem rather silly. That's because they're literally blocking out information that suggests they may be wrong. But I certainly am not a advocate of just, you know, turning off our head and trusting our sweaty palms or racing pulses. I think, like Captain Sullenberger, sometimes it's essential that you really be deliberate about stuff, and often it's essential that you really be deliberate about stuff. I think the key is knowing, when to think like that and when to trust your sweaty palm.
Well, I think that's a perfect time now to wrap things up, and I really want to thank you for joining us
tonight. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.